Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
July the 23rd marked the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, marking its status as the longest ruling Communist Party in history. It was founded in Shanghai in 1921. And this anniversary happened to coincide with roughly the first six-month milestone of the Biden presidency, a period which, surprising to some, saw no improvement in Sino-American relations as the new administration continued many of the policies, if not the rhetoric, of its predecessor. This period has been characterized by now two tense diplomatic meetings, increasing concerns over everything from the data security, foreign listings, human rights in Xinjiang and in Hong Kong, the security and status of Taiwan, the domestic situation in the United States. All of this, of course, in the context of urgent global issues, COVID and climate change, most importantly, requiring both Chinese and American joint and individual action. So here with me today to help sort through all of these issues, I'm joined by two of my colleagues. Paul Hanley is Teneo's chairman of the Asia-Pacific region. He heads our Beijing office and he is the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing. Paul served Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama in the National Security Council as the director for Chinese, Mongolian, and Taiwanese affairs. But he was also the White House representative to the U.S. negotiating team at the six-party talks, nuclear negotiations. And Gabe Wildow leads our political risk analysis of China from the United States. Gabe spent over 14 years in China, most recently as the Shanghai Bureau Chief of the Financial Times, and before that with Reuters and Gavikal Dragonomics. So thank you guys both for joining me today. So here we are. I think we all recall the footing that the relationship got off to with the new Biden administration in Alaska. The atmospherics were just as bad at the diplomatic meetings in Tianjin last week, involving Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman. And in his July 1st 100th anniversary speech, Xi Jinping warned that anyone who challenged the country's sovereignty would, quote, crack their heads and spill blood on the Great Wall of Steel built from the flesh and blood of 1.4 billion Chinese people. He sounded more like Kim Jong-un than the leader of one of the world's great superpowers. So give us a sense of where we are in this most important bilateral relationship of the 21st century. Paul, let's start with you. Give us the level set here.
Well, thanks, Kevin. And, you know, I agree with your general premise. You know, the first 6 months of the Biden administration have been, I think, tougher and more continuity than perhaps some had expected, especially in China, or at least that they had hoped for. But that being said, you know, my own sense is that this is not the end of the story. I think what we're seeing in terms of the Biden administration is a deliberate, and I think it will be a sequenced approach to China, beginning with a strong focus on and priority on domestic renewal and outreach to allies. And then I think that is the first critical piece of their China policy. And frankly, their foreign policy writ large, to be honest, because you hear the same explanation when you ask them about policy toward Russia or policy toward other key parts of the world. So, you know, they want to get those two because they think it will give them, it will allow them to approach China and other foreign policy issues from a position of greater strength. So on the domestic renewal side, we've seen the administration, you know, putting efforts forward to ramp up vaccine distributions, get COVID under control, pass stimulus bill, other legislation on Capitol Hill, infrastructure bill, outreach to allies. I think we've seen some successes. I think they've begun that process of coordinating with allies much better than the previous administration, especially on its approach to China. You look at the Quad, the G7, NATO, US-EU. You've had several joint statements around Xinjiang with partners and allies around the world. The joint statement on China's hack of Microsoft Exchange email servers. These are all, I think, important successes. And then in terms of, you mentioned the dialogue with China. You know, I think we're starting to see some high-level dialogue. Obviously, you mentioned the meetings in Alaska, Wendy Sherman's visit to Tianjin, climate policy. John Kerry went to Shanghai earlier this year. I will say the trade and economic, you know, policy reps do speak by phone, and they've done that on multiple occasions this summer. So there is dialogue taking place. However, what you're seeing more is both sides kind of laying down their bottom lines and clarifying, you know, what actions they want the other side to take that they see as undermining their own interest. There hasn't been a lot of constructive dialogue. My own sense is what we're doing, the two sides, is going through a process of trying to figure out how to position themselves with regard to the other in a new era, frankly, of U.S.-China relations, where a lot has changed and a lot is changing in terms of power dynamics, in terms of each country's perceptions of how it sees itself and how it sees the other in the world. And neither side at this point is in a particular hurry. You've got, you know, as I said, the sequencing approach on the U.S. side. You know, China seems happy to wait. They're saying they're looking to the U.S. to try to take the initiative and improve their relationship because they blame the previous administration 100% for the downturn in relations. And the rhetoric you're also hearing where the Chinese side says the U.S. doesn't have the legitimacy to criticize China about its own situation, domestic situation. Human rights. China's clearly feeling much more confident. That being said, there is some discussion about a meeting between our two presidents here, maybe in the fall on the margins of the G20 or COP26. We'll see. It's not clear yet, but that will be an important marker. But that's basically what I think is happening right now between the U.S. and China.
Just a quick question with regards to, and maybe this is not that important a question because the messaging is more consistent out of this White House than out of some of its predecessors on China, as well as on many other policies. But for our listeners, when it comes to the administration, who are the key voices that they ought to be listening to on China policy? You know, obviously beyond the president himself.
We within the administration.
Within the U.S. administration, yeah.
Okay. I say outside of the administration, I would say it would be Gabe and me and you. no, but in the administration, I think that's a good point because, you know, right now, one of the factors I think that's, you know, delaying, you know, a sort of coherent China policy is the fact that key players are not yet in key positions. So you have Kurt Campbell, Laura Rosenberger, and others in the National Security Council. So they are, you know, they're pretty full up right now. At the State Department, the Assistant Secretary for East Asia, Dan Crittenbrink, hasn't been confirmed yet. Treasury, Commerce, USTR, those positions, you know, there's a lot of positions there that still have to be filled. And a lot of the critical policies toward China are going to come out of those agencies, Treasury, Commerce, USTR. And then, of course, we don't, you know, China has its new ambassador in place, Qin Gang, just within the last week or two in the U.S. We do not have an ambassador to replace Ambassador Branstad from the Trump administration. So that's also a delay in terms of getting through these formal policy reviews because those key people are not yet in place.
And, you know, you mentioned in your initial remarks that on the one hand, both sides, China included, are sort of willing to be you know, willing to wait and willing to be patient here. On the other hand, you made reference to this expectation that the Biden administration will undo some of the quote unquote wrongs of the Trump administration. 6 months into this, do you get any sense of Chinese frustration that does not appear to be happening in the U.S.?
So I still maintain quite a bit of dialogue with, you know, Chinese experts and business leaders, and I sense a huge degree of frustration. You know, the official narrative, as I said, is that the downturn in relations is 100% the responsibility of the Trump administration. There's very little self-reflection about China's own policies and behavior rhetoric and the rest. And so there was a hope that the Biden team would come in. And I personally think the Biden team has taken a number of important steps to improve our approach to China, you know, in particular, our tone, our outreach to allies. In my view, these are positive steps. But on the Chinese side, they were hoping that the Biden team would reverse many of the policies and actions of the Trump administration, in particular the tariffs, and they haven't seen that, and that's frustrating to them. China wants to stabilize relations, but they're not putting a lot forward in terms of concrete ideas for how to do that. They're not offering a lot to do that, with the exception of dialogue. But dialogue, you know, many in the U.S. see as a sort of a mixed bag, because the Chinese don't always, you know, make a lot of commitments in dialogues, and there's a sense that the Chinese may use dialogues to drag out issues. So, yes, there's huge frustration, I think, in China. They were wanting more change. They were wanting the administration to reverse a lot of the Trump administration's policies. They haven't seen it. They see a lot of tough rhetoric around strategic competition, and they don't like that. And so in a sense, you know, they're, I think, waiting and watching, and they don't see a lot of upside right now to being proactive and to, you know, giving signals of where China might be willing to make some changes or modifications or concessions. Very little of that right now.
You know, Gabe, you know, Paul's been talking about sort of where we are right now. But if you pull back a little bit here, you know, when you talk to, you know, your interlocutors in China and in your studies of China's government, you know, what do you think right now is their view of U.S. motivations, big time, you know, big scale strategic motivations with regards to China? And do you think those are in fact realistic? Or do they align with what our actual strategic policy toward China is? And I'm talking about, you know, there is a perception, yes, that the U.S. wants to essentially, with its allies, contain China's rise and prevent it from assuming its rightful place in global affairs. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think you put it pretty well. China's leadership is cynical or skeptical about U.S. statements about human rights and about democratic values. They basically see U.S. motives as being about containment. And they don't really think that, although the U.S. government raises various grievances, whether it's about the South China Sea or about intellectual property, about mercantilist trade policies, ultimately they think it's about the existing global hegemon trying to prevent a new global hegemon from supplanting it. And therefore, they don't believe that any specific concessions by the U.S. or by China would really lead to an improvement of relations, so long as China is not willing to give up its ambitions to become the world's largest economy, to become at least a regional hegemon, or at least to increase its influence in Asia at the expense of the U.S., if not globally. And so I think that is kind of the source of the paralysis and stalemate that Paul described, in terms of neither side being willing to compromise and neither side really believing that the other side is operating in good faith in terms of being willing to take substantive steps. So I think where we stand, therefore, is a kind of these dialogues and these diplomatic encounters. Maybe the best we can hope for is that things don't get worse, or that the two sides understand each other better, can avoid miscalculations and accidents, because no one really expects a breakthrough or kind of substantive deliverables, even if this meeting that Paul referenced between the two presidents happens at the end of this year. It's hard to be optimistic that anything is going to come out of that that would mark a shift in direction.
You know, two of the real hallmarks of the Xi Jinping era have been, one, that China has taken on a more they've become more ideological, right? More ideological since the Mao leadership. And the other is the great confidence that China continues to demonstrate under him. Be very clear of his perception that the East is rising and that the West is declining. But, you know, I think that over time, we would, you know, China watchers would note that you can't really straight line anything out of China. The leaders since Mao have differed quite a bit in their approaches, and so I'm wondering how much, especially now that Xi Jinping has also eliminated term limits effectively for himself, you know, how much should we straight line about Chinese policy and ideology at this point? And, you know, my second question is, on the one hand, they're demonstrating great confidence. On the other hand, they will squash anything that looks like dissent or deviation from their policy goals, which suggests a greater insecurity than their rhetoric would imply. And I'm wondering if that is the case. Is there deep insecurity, and what is that stem from? Dave, that's
so. I would say it's useful to distinguish here between kind of domestic political trends and elite politics within China versus China's kind of stance towards the world. And so what we've seen in the first domain is a kind of centralization of power around President Xi, more power in the Communist Party versus the state apparatus, a crackdown on domestic dissent, and a somewhat more statist economic policy, state interventionist economic policy that I think there's some grumbling about within the Chinese policy elite, at least in some circles among more liberal economic policy types. Then on the other hand, if we look at China's stance towards the U.S. or Chinese foreign policy, there I think I think there's a greater degree of consensus. In terms of, even if you imagine that President Xi had sort of secret enemies who wanted to weaken him, maybe even unseat him at next year's Party Congress or force him to not take a third 5-year term as General Secretary, even if you thought that those were the trends in elite politics, I am skeptical that that kind of change would lead to a substantial shift in China's foreign policy, because I think there's a degree of consensus that, you're going back to what I said earlier, that U.S. wants to contain China, but China doesn't want to be contained. China thinks it deserves a seat at the high table in global affairs. They intend to be the world's largest economy. They intend to increase their technological self-sufficiency. They intend to use their economic might to increase their geopolitical and diplomatic influence around the world. The core sovereignty issues like Hong Kong, South China Sea, Taiwan, they're not very willing to compromise. And I think any other leader, even if Xi were to be sidelined, would kind of, or even if there was a shift back more towards the kind of collective leadership we saw in the Hu Jintao era, I don't think that would fundamentally shift a lot of those, you know, key foreign policy objectives. So, and the Chinese public has become more nationalistic and is kind of on board with that basic agenda as well. So we could see some tweaks around the edges under a new leadership. Certainly there are people that are very uncomfortable with, there are people in China who are uncomfortable with the way that Xi has centralized power. Certainly the way that the latest, and I know we're going to get to this, but the latest ructions in financial markets around the technology crackdown, just the way that's been carried out is disturbing including to people within China. But if we're looking at the key sources of conflict between the U.S. and China, there's not a strong sort of pro-democracy movement within China where that if it succeeded, it could put at ease the U.S. administration, the U.S. public about China's motivations and China's place in the world. I mean, a different China where collective leadership was stronger, where Xi was sidelined, would not be a democratic China. And so it would not be a China where, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Google were uncensored. And so therefore, I think, and what we've seen from the Biden administration, I think, is a greater willingness on its side to kind of frame the conflict with China in terms of values and in terms of ideology, whereas Trump was more transactional. And, you know, if the Trump view seemed to be, at least before the pandemic, that if they got the trade deal and if certain specific concerns were addressed, you know, we could ease tensions with China. But the Biden administration is much more has been much more forthright in framing it as a contest between democracy and authoritarianism. And in that context, I think compromise becomes a lot more difficult. And so from the Chinese perspective, there's not much prospect that even shifts within domestic politics would change the bilateral relationship or the geopolitical tensions with the West.
And then, what do you think on this issue of China's confidence or insecurity domestically? It seems to me that notwithstanding that they are now the longest surviving Communist Party ruling government, that, you know, this kind of stifling of dissent historically has not led to longevity in regimes. And so, you know, is it internal insecurity, or is it looking at what happened ultimately to the Soviet Union and so on? What's behind that?
Yeah, I mean, it could be seen as a form of insecurity. I think the Chinese leadership does believe that if you loosen things just a little bit, they can quickly spiral out of control. And there's no room for kind of partial loosening because chaos is always just around the corner. So you could call that paranoia, but I think it's not paranoia insofar as they think that things are going well. The current approach is working, so they're just going to stick with it, and they see no reason to shift course. The ideological tightening is, at least from Xi's perspective, is having its intended result. So there's a way in which that's paranoia, but I think you're right that the Soviet influence or the China's interpretation of what happened to the Soviet Union is very much influential here, where, you know, they basically see Gorbachev as hastening the decline of the Soviet Union, that it hit the perestroika and detente were sort of, or at least perestroika was a mistake that led to the collapse. And that's an object lesson where, you know, you give an inch and your opponents take a mile. I think we can also see the influence of that, of the Soviet experience in terms of China's ethnic policies in Xinjiang and elsewhere, where they saw that allowing autonomy or allowing ethnic tensions to roil unchecked ultimately ends up having weakening the imperial core, ends up feeling the effects of turmoil on the periphery. And so that's why we see this very hardline policy in Xinjiang.
I want to just say a couple of things on confidence and insecurity, because that is a great question. And I just, you mentioned the 100th anniversary of the party, and, you know, that's an important event for China. And I think it's important for our listeners to understand, you know, there's a huge sense of huge ambition, pride in China. You know, this was they achieved the first centennial goal of becoming a moderately prosperous society. I think there's a great degree of confidence and expectations for China's future. And on Xi Jinping, I know Gabe wasn't suggesting, you know, that there's a maybe he was, but there's a risk to him. I think that by all accounts, his grip on power right now is probably stronger than ever. And I think Gabe would agree with that. There's no sign he's leaving office at the 20th Party Congress next fall. And he's wanting to position himself, and he's making progress in doing this, as one of the great leaders of China. The propaganda in China, there's a saying that says, you know, Mao helped China stand up, Deng helped China get rich, and Xi Jinping is helping China get strong. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of support for that. There was a hugely ideological components in his speech. The main feature of those ideological components being the fact that he attributed the root causes for China's successes and, you know, development over the last three decades, you know, in China's new strength and new power to the Chinese Communist Party and to Marxism and Leninism, not to the reform and opening up era launched by Deng over three decades ago. And as you said, despite, you know, he was saying in May at a, you know, party study session that China should be, that Chinese leaders should present a more lovable image of China. Of course, we saw the hardline rhetoric coming out of that. And then finally, I think there was, you know, what we see often, this victim narrative, you know, the 100 years of humiliation, which helps to incite popular support in China. And push back on, you know, what is perceived as foreign
200
bullying.
Years of humiliation. That's not.
Yeah, now it's 200 years. So and so as a sense, I think as China, it, you know, and Xi Jinping says China's moving closer to the world center of the world stage, you know, they're going to be less tolerant of this foreign bullying. So I think the 100th anniversary event, I think you could see a lot of what you talked about in terms of confidence, more assertiveness. And I think that, you know, with China's handling of the pandemic after the early missteps, the economic resilience of China, and then as they look around the world and they see Western democracies, they see rising populism in Europe, they see political chaos and unrest in the United States. And that, I think, gives them much greater sense of confidence. But you're absolutely right. There is a debate. You know, is it that China's confidence, or is it that it's a fragile power secretly, you know, trying to stay afloat? And I believe I agree with Gabe that they use that paranoia and insecurity, you know, really to stay focused on the mission at hand and to stay in power. But the things that Gabe talked about, the centralization of power around Xi, more control of policy by the senior party leaders versus the state apparatus, you know, repression of the domestic audience, you know, a return to sort of Mao era tactics. I think these are all potential risks. Right now, this snapshot in time, there's great confidence, and I think the leadership's doing quite well. Downturn in the economy, some crisis with the United States. There's a number of things that could emerge that could cause the administration, the leadership in China to have difficulties. When you centralize power around one leader, if things are going really well, that's really good for that leader and the party. When things don't go, start not to go well, that's also a risk to the leader and the party.
So we're going to turn to the economy here in a few minutes, but since you brought it up, Paul, I want to turn to potential crisis point for one second here. And I asked you to level set on the overall relationship at the outset, but let's level set on another issue here, and that's Taiwan. You know, obviously a lot has been made of the increasing military might of China and its increasing assertiveness, both rhetorically, diplomatically, and militarily with regards to Taiwan. And you've seen some hyperbolic Western reaction to that as well. You know, The Economist magazine put on its cover that it's the most dangerous place in the world with the big target right on Taiwan and whatnot. Give us your sense of where the Taiwan issue is right now and how realistic it is as a near-term trigger point, or where do you think it becomes an actual real strategic concern?
So this is a great question. And I will start with the 100th anniversary event. You know, if you look at the language that the party line that came out of that event, you come away with the conclusion that the party line has remained unchanged with regard to Taiwan reunification, because in Xi's centennial speech, you know, he talked about the 1992 consensus and the policy of peaceful reunification. So there's not a lot you could take away from that speech that would give you a sense there's any sort of urgency to deal with it through more aggressive military means in the near term. But as you indicate, a lot of analysts are looking at this and seeing signals that Beijing might be reconsidering this peaceful approach and contemplating some sort of armed unification effort. These, you know, folks that are pointing to this are noting public support in China through media, through social media, also some official within the Chinese military establishment, for example, support for some sort of armed effort to reunify with Taiwan. They're also analysts also saying that China is beginning to doubt that the U.S. has the military power to stop China from taking Taiwan. So maybe there's a window of opportunity right now. And that the U.S. doesn't have the international clout anymore to rally an effective coalition around China. You know, the national security law is a good example. You know, a lot, the international response, a lot of angry statements, sanctions. But at the end of the day, did China really incur huge costs? Right. And so that's the analysis around maybe China's looking, Chinese leaders are looking to do something fairly quickly, aggressively. Other analysts in the U.S., however, I think would say that for Beijing to launch, and I put myself in this camp, to be honest with you, for Beijing to launch an unprovoked attack on Taiwan, you know, Chinese leaders would basically, you know, as my friend Ryan Haas says, have to mortgage all other national priorities in service of that one goal. And there's a lot, if you listen to the centennial speech, there's 9 or 10 major national goals that came ahead of discussion on Taiwan. They've also got to factor in that, you know, an unprovoked attack would almost certainly involve U.S. forces to some degree. Could they control the escalation, geographic escalation of that? Risk of nuclear escalation is involved. What would it do to China's image in the world? Huge anxieties would be created in the region around, you know, China as a military aggressive power. And this could lead countries in the region to bandwagon. This is something China's been trying to avoid. And of course, there's risks of capital flight, trade diversions, you know, and this could have a significant impact on China's, you know, economic competitiveness. So, you know, despite all of these huge downsides for China, we can't rule it out 100%. That China won't decide to sort of proceed. And so it's important for the U.S. to be very clear and try to remain an active deterrent. But I think in the near term, the risk of some sort of military attack by China is low. Now, the last thing I'll say is, you know, China is preparing, you know, even if they're not preparing for some sort of military attack here shortly, there are, you know, a number of other tactics, these gray zone tactics that they're doing every single day. Intimidation, coercion, Chinese drills, activities, you know, in Taiwan's air defense identification zone. And these are used to try to wear down and subdue Taiwan over time. And so, you know, we need to stay attuned to those as well and have policies directed to mitigate the effectiveness of those.
You know, one final question on the strategic front. It's become public in recent days that China is rapidly building ICBM missile silos, land-based, in various parts of the country. How do you and how does the national security apparatus in the United States, the military apparatus, view this development? Is China on a rapid pace of increasing its nuclear arsenal, which just to level set for everybody has been quite small versus it's been more a deterrent in nature for China versus the arsenals of the United States and Russia? Or are they trying to gear up for what they think is an inevitably having to enter into strategic arms control negotiations ultimately with the U.S. and Russia and other powers?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. I mean, these developments are pretty significant. And they're starting to get more attention. But, you know, as you said, the Chinese have had this minimum deterrent strategy, which means that they possess, you know, no more nuclear weapons than is necessary, they believe, to defeat an adversary. China has got about 1/5, I think, of the U.S. arsenal and the Russian arsenal. And, you know, now there's, you know, upwards of these, you know, 200 new silos that have been identified. So, you know, there's a lot of speculation. I mean, the point, the fact that we have to speculate is not a good sign because it means that there's very little communication in our military to military space in terms, you know, so the Chinese can sort of, you know, reassure especially major nuclear powers in terms of what they're trying to do. They may be, you know, wanting a nuclear arsenal, you know, that matches its, you know, China's increased economic, technological, and military strength. They also could be concerned about American, you know, missile defenses or Iran's nuclear buildup. You know, they're also maybe concerned that the silos that they have now are vulnerable to attack, and so they build, you know, 200, and they can place, you know, the minimum amount of missiles that they have now in any of those 200. So it could be, you know, reducing the risk to those missiles. There's also speculation that the Chinese know that the Biden administration or feel that the Biden administration will want to enter in some sort of negotiation with China around nuclear arms talks. And given that China has so few nuclear weapons, they may want to build more so that they have more leverage at the table. So it could be, you know, any of those. But the lack of transparency, I think, is concerning here. There should be some discussion between the U.S. and China. Otherwise, you know, you create threat perceptions, and then countries are, you know, will come to their own conclusions. But this is where I think, you know, we need to have more dialogue about what this is all about.
Dave, you and Paul both talked about, you know, the sort of the continued policy direction of the Biden administration on some of the economic policies that the Trump administration implemented on the trade front, et cetera, et cetera. But in recent weeks, a lot of the news has been around China's crackdown on the technology sector and on foreign listings. I guess the question here is, you know, more narrowly focused is, you know, is there some sort of a debate going on among the Chinese leadership right now about how far to go in cracking down on foreign listings? And more broadly, should anyone derive anything from this about Xi's attitude toward the ostensibly private sector writ large? Or are we reading too much into it?
I think there are some investors who probably are reading too much into the recent market turmoil and the recent policy actions by China against the tech sector and against foreign listings, or maybe they're taking not quite the right lesson from it. I think that the big context for what we've seen against the tech sector over the last several months is we see that, you know, China's policy objectives are no longer limited to just encouraging growth and welcoming foreign investment as the top priority. There's this common prosperity agenda, which relates to social equality and kind of non-economic quality of life type of concerns. And the various crackdowns, whether it's against anti-monopoly or about data security or about the education sector or now about the low-wage workers who work for these food delivery platforms, or whether it's about the impact of video games on children. All these crackdowns potentially hurt economic growth, at least in the short term. They definitely cause financial turmoil. I think what we see from the leadership is a willingness to accept those costs because these are important priorities, and growth is, in terms of China's legitimacy or the Communist Party's legitimacy, addressing these concerns around family and family stress, about education, around the impact on low wage workers and the kind of working conditions of these delivery drivers. All these things the party sees as key to its legitimacy. Specifically on foreign listings, I mean, this is a concern related to data security, and the concern that if companies like Didi list on foreign stock exchanges, Didi Global, the Uber type ride hailing app, if they list on foreign exchanges, this could lead to the leakage of valuable data or sensitive data from China to abroad to foreign regulators. And so we're going to see regulations to address this, but I don't think we're going to see a total cutoff of foreign listings. I think China actually still very much values the fact that certain Chinese companies can access foreign capital markets and can grab foreign investment. But it's no longer the overriding priority compared to other priorities. So they're trying to strike a balance. So I think that, you know, the priorities around social equality and common prosperity are the way to view this, rather than seeing it as President Xi or the Communist Party being broadly hostile to the private sector, or about trying to show Jack Ma who is boss, or show Pony Ma, the founder of Tencent, who is boss, or kind of remind companies that the Communist Party has the final say on everything. I can tell you, no Chinese business leader was under any illusion before the recent crackdowns about who the boss was. And so there was no need for any kind of reminder. It's really about achieving this set of policy objectives and being willing to nor is it about kind of trying to punish foreign investors specifically. It's really more about a kind of indifference to the interest of foreign investor of domestic and foreign investors, the investor class generally, as compared to trying to pursue these other policy objectives. So what we see now is investors poring over President Xi's past speeches or poring over People's Daily to try to get policy signals about, you know, what the next regulatory crackdown will be. But broadly, I think we see a willingness to kind of address these social issues, even at the expense of investors and powerful companies.
Yeah. Deng Xiaoping said to get rich is glorious, just not as rich as Jack Ma, apparently. You issued a note to clients earlier this week about the recent Politburo meetings and their acknowledgement and sort of policy responses to, economic slowdown after the initial rebound from the pandemic. Obviously, now you've got the Delta variant appearing in, pretty much across China, albeit at much smaller numbers than we're seeing in the United States and other countries. But quite simply, this is going to probably further delay consumer rebound in China. And so you're hinting that we should expect further loosening of policy in China. Can you talk a little bit about what you expect out of economic policymaking as we head toward that 5-year Party Congress later next year?
Yeah. So here we're talking about really short-term trends in China's economy and economic policy. Paul and I have been talking about kind of big picture secular trends, but the Politburo meets every 3 months to talk about the economy and to set policy. And what we saw at the end of July was a pretty clear signal that China's recovery from the pandemic, economic recovery has been strong. And so China was really tightening for the last 8 months, tightening fiscal and monetary policy because the recovery was strong. And now they're shifting back towards a loosening stance because growth is starting to slow. And now we have this outbreak of the Delta variant and, again, a very strong reaction in terms of lockdowns, partial lockdowns and travel restrictions and response to this outbreak that would be considered tiny by global standards. But China has this zero tolerance policy. And so we have an economic impact now where the economy was already slowing. And that's what the Politburo acknowledged just a few days ago. But it's going the economic hit as a result of the Delta variant is now going to kind of compound the slowdown. And so China may therefore have to accelerate the policy loosening that it was already planning to take, but was going to do very gradually because growth is still kind of on a glide path, at least for the rest of this year. And the growth concerns were mainly about next year. But growth for the rest of this year was expected to be driven by consumption and consumer services. That's what had recovered relatively slowly compared to the kind of industrial economy, and the manufacturing sector had kind of led the recovery out of the pandemic. Consumer services, because of lingering COVID concerns, consumer services, travel, entertainment, dining had recovered much more slowly. That was expected to pick up the slack now in the coming months. But because of this new outbreak, and the summer travel season is basically canceled now in China, at least for August. And so that's going to set back the consumption recovery that everyone expected. And it's going to put more pressure on policymakers to kind of ramp back up the investment-driven growth and investment-driven stimulus that they've traditionally relied on, but which they've been trying to get away from. But since we know that going into next year and the Party Congress, they very much want strong headline growth, they're going to be under pressure to kind of return, at least to some extent, return to that old investment playbook, rely on infrastructure, rely on housing in order to drive growth, to put President Xi and his group of senior leaders in a strong political position heading into that Party Congress.
The other big event in China ahead of the Party Congress is the Olympics. And I'm just struck, obviously, because we're watching the sort of the winding down of the Tokyo Games right now. But I'm wondering, Paul, what you also think on this front. When we go back to the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, the Summer Games, It was clearly a giant coming out party for China on the global stage. I think we all remember the opening ceremonies of that being quite dramatic. What does the Olympics mean to them this time around? And what should we expect, not in terms of sport and gaming and all that, but in terms of what's the message that China is going to send with it this time around? And does that pose any risks for, you know, global advertisers of the Olympic movement? Obviously, a lot of American and Western corporations rely heavily on being able to get their message out during the Olympic Games. You know, is there going to be risk this time around because of all of these bigger tensions between the U.S. and China?
No, it's a great question. And, you know, we're starting to look at that very, very closely. I think given the fact that we've seen some of the difficulties with the Tokyo Olympics and the fact that it's been fairly subdued, I think, you know, Tokyo wanted to use the Olympics to say, you know, the world is back. We're beyond COVID. And to use the Olympics to sort of signal that and have a huge amount of enthusiasm behind the Olympics, which would obviously benefit Tokyo and the Olympics itself. And that hasn't really played out. It's been a great Olympics, don't get me wrong, but it hasn't been, I think, what officials in Tokyo had wanted. And I think so the Chinese will see an opportunity there. Of course, yes, to say the world is getting beyond COVID, but most importantly, to demonstrate, you know, what the Chinese have done in dealing with COVID and getting the economy back up and running. That's not going to be easy, especially as Gabe was referring to with these new Delta variants that are emerging, you know, in China. And China still remains, you know, quite closed off to foreigners. So there's a lot of uncertainties in terms of how they're going to play the Olympics. But they clearly want to use it as an opportunity to showcase China's strength and capabilities in terms of dealing with the virus, getting their economy back and up and running much quicker than other countries in the world did, and all the rest. Whether they'll be able to do that or not, I don't know. You'll remember, of course, you know, and I was President Bush's China director at the time. You know, he went to the Olympics, and that was a big boon. The Chinese really wanted heads of state from countries around the world to go, and they put a lot of pressure on companies. President Bush wasn't under any pressure. He decided a year in advance he was going to go to support the American athletes. President Biden will not go to the Olympics this year. That I can guarantee you. There's a lot of on Capitol Hill. There's a lot of discussions and meetings around what Capitol Hill should do, what Congress should do around U.S. corporate sponsorship to the Olympics, and that's a space that we need to watch play out over the next several months as we approach the Olympics in February 2022.
You know, guys, I have a question here for both of you. When you contextualize everything we've been talking about, from the big picture relations between China and the U.S., China's own trajectory, and then even these more near term economic issues and the like, when you talk to Fortune 100 American corporations and their leaders, do you feel that, you know, that there is a very realistic view of China, and that the calibration efforts on the, and I know I'm asking you to talk about this writ large and not on a company by company or even industry specific basis, but in general terms, you know, is the recalibration of Western corporations toward their China dealings, whether it's using them as a source of goods or as a market that they're trying to do business in, you know, or do they need to move more to reflect the reality that you guys have just presented?
You know, I think that you hear a lot of companies, you know, talking about reducing, you know, first of all, there's a huge amount of risk and uncertainty in the business landscape in China, no doubt. But there's also a huge amount of potential. And so, you know, companies are trying to figure out, you know, how to maneuver through that. With the increased risk, you hear a lot of companies, you know, saying that they want to take steps to diversify their risk and doing a lot of analysis. You know, my sense is that they're doing some things, but there's probably more that they could actually do. You know, they don't, you know, because a lot of this is sort of happening incrementally over time, some of these more negative changes in China. And they don't want to wake up in 10 years and say, you know, I should have done more, you know, 10 years ago. But I think one of the misperceptions is that, you know, that this all comes out of the blue, that it's all a surprise when things happen. The truth is, you know, Gabe talked about the regulatory pressure that we're seeing now. You know, the truth is that regulatory authorities in China are actually, you know, well known for advanced signaling. You know, and Gabe and myself, we try very, very hard to watch those signals. So I guess there is a lot that companies can do, and we talk to companies a lot about what they can do to diversify, to reduce their risk, to diversify. You know, understanding the relationship between the industry that companies are in, or that firms are investing in terms of the Chinese national strategies and policies. You know, that's an important element. You know, making sure that, you know, there's no excuse, that you're, you know, in full compliance, so that Chinese regulatory authorities can't go after you. You know, actively monitoring, for example, regulatory and policy space, you know, at a sophisticated level. You know, this stuff can be done. As I said, that, you know, there is advanced signaling that takes place. So there's a lot of things that companies can do, and we often find that they're not doing, that would be very helpful in helping them think about how to maneuver through what's increasingly a much more complicated business environment.
Gabe, how about you?
So I agree with everything Paul said. I think, you know, if the question is how much are companies doing enough to take account of the risk and to plan accordingly, I think it's useful to distinguish between kind of a base case, planning based on your base case versus planning based on tail risks or contingencies. And the reason I say that is because, you know, despite all the talk of decoupling, what we see in the trade data, what we see in the investment data, is is foreign investors and foreign companies remain very interested in investing in China. I mean, and it's very striking. For example, you know, some of the commentary in the Western investment community around the market turmoil related to all these regulatory actions in China is, China's becoming uninvestable. It's too unpredictable, and the government intervention is too much. Meanwhile, if you look at the financial market data, the fund flow data, you see foreign investors poured more into China last month than, you know, over the last several. It was a big month for net inflows into China equities. So my clients don't think China is uninvestable. That is for sure. On the other hand, and I think what that speaks to is that, you know, the commercial opportunities, the business opportunities in China are still very strong. Where the risk comes from and where maybe not enough planning is happening is on these kind of tail risks or contingencies related to kind of U.S. policy. We have been continually surprised by the toughness of some of the policies over the last couple of years, both under Trump and under Biden. And so, depending on your read of U.S. politics and politics in other Western countries, you know, it's possible that foreign companies are not being careful enough, and they're not planning for the contingency that, like, the government may force us to decouple, even if the commercial logic, even if we want to keep being there, we may not be allowed. And so, that may not be, you know, the probability of that may only be 20%. But if you're a huge company, you know, 20% probability, 10% is, you still have to plan for it. So I don't think we're going to see a catastrophic breakdown of commercial business relations between China and the West, but nor can I rule it out. And so I think, you know, companies probably need to plan for those kind of contingencies, even if they're not that likely.
You know, final question for you guys. This is a big one, so you only have a couple minutes to answer this. But, you know, it's got to be, I have to think for both of you, it's an amazing time, right? To be a China watcher, a China advisor, a China analyst, because you're seeing something play out in real time that nobody ever has really done before, right? Or it's been 100+ years since it last happened, which is, you know, this supplanting of one economy by another as the largest, and it's happened only a handful of times in human history. And of course, as we all know, with the exception of the U.S. taking over from the U.K., it's very rarely happened peacefully. I we can go on and on about all of the mutual interests of the U.S. and China, the existential interests of the U.S. and China, the commercial ties between the U.S. and China. How worried are you ultimately that not next year, maybe not 5 years, not 10, that there's some sort of clash, whether it's military or not, but something that would be catastrophic to economic interests of the United States and the Western and the Western economies and to China's itself, that some sort of conflict is how likely is it?
You know, I think that things are difficult right now, but I don't think, you know, that in the near term we're at huge risk for conflict. You know, with the exception perhaps of, you know, some sort of inadvertent military collision in the South China Sea or in the airspace. Of course, we remember the EP3 crisis, which took place back in 2001 in April. And if we were to imagine, you know, if you look back in 2001, 20 years ago, where our two planes collided, you know, a U.S. crew was crash landed in Hainan Island. And through creative diplomacy, the two countries were able to work through that, get our crew back, get our plane back, albeit in small boxes cut up into pieces. But nevertheless, we worked through it, and our relationship even got better after that. And I think large reason for that was that the leaders on both sides saw it in their interest at that time to do that, to resolve that. And so they spent a lot of diplomatic effort to do that, and they were able to do that. If you were to think of some sort of an EP3 crisis today, given the domestic politics in both countries, given the level of nationalism that we see, you know, in particular in China, but also in the U.S., and the fact that in 2001, we didn't have social media. So add a social media component to that, I worry very much if there is some sort of inadvertent collision. And our forces, you know, China's military has grown considerably. They've got a lot more ships out there operating, you know, around our ships. And so, you know, just by virtue of the fact that there's more aircraft and ships out there, the risk of some clash goes up. I mean, I think encounters are quite professional right now, and I hope it stays that way, but it doesn't mean there isn't a risk. And so, you know, right now, I think that is the biggest risk of some sort of, you know, the escalation around some event like that could be very difficult for our leaders to manage. And so, you know, despite the antagonism right now between the U.S. and China, we do, and I have an article coming out this week on, we got to get our military-to-military dialogue, our crisis management mechanisms up and running for the purposes that I just described.
And Gabe, I'm going to give the last word to you on this.
Yeah, I think Paul put it pretty well. I think the risk of an acute conflict is low. But Paul's also right that should one occur, the dynamics in favor of escalation would be very difficult to resist because the politics on both sides would prevent either side from kind of backing down the way we saw in the Hainan crisis. On the other hand, I do think both sides, maybe especially the Chinese side, China is not incentivized at this moment to spark an acute crisis because of what we were discussing earlier. They believe time is on their side. So if a crisis is destined to occur, they would prefer it occur 5 or 10 years from now, when they believe they'll be stronger, relatively speaking, than they are today. So I think the risk is low, but yeah, accidents do happen, and if something does happen, it could be difficult to get out of.
Well, we have to leave it there. China's obviously, and China-U.S., big issues. We will continue to address them on this call. So, gentlemen, we'll have you back.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.